Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Vote Plan Podcast. This is your host, Marquise Olison. This is the podcast where we talk about voting, elections, technology, the future, with brilliant people from the wide spectrum of this United States of America. Our goal here is to make sure that every single American casts a ballot on or before Election Day by making sure they have a plan to vote. Today, we have a special guest. We have Mr. David Walker. He is on the board of the ACLU. He is a professor at Drake University. He is brilliant. He knows these things insides and outs. He's been working on some issues that should be near and dear to a lot of our listeners' hearts. Felon disenfranchisement. Those folks that haven't been able to vote because of some criminal history in their past, he oversaw or worked with organizations to help make sure that in Iowa, that was no longer the case. So please give a warm round of applause to Mr. David Walker. There's nobody here, David. It's just me and you, but I'm imagining them riding in their cars and clapping.
I can hear the sound of one hand clapping now. I just make a couple of additions. I'm on the board of directors of the ACLU of Iowa, not the national board. And I am a retired professor and former dean at Drake Law School in Des Moines. And I'm on the executive committee and co-chair the legal redress committee for the NAACP in Iowa, and also its Des Moines branch. And a lot of my work, most of my work has been done through the NAACP.
That's amazing. You know, I'll be honest, there's probably going to be a few listeners that think that when we say Drake University, that it's in Toronto because of the rapper name.
It's got a great basketball team down in North Carolina.
Oh, yeah. So let's just dive into this right now. So what is some of the work that you've done to help felon disenfranchisement in Iowa?
Well, this has been a major issue in Iowa and honestly across the United States. As I know you have, you followed the felon disenfranchisement issue, you know it traces its origins candidly to a lot of the Jim Crow efforts to disenfranchise newly freed African Americans following the South's loss in the Civil War. In Iowa, the manner in which it was interpreted and seemed to read was that if you committed a felony, you lost your right to vote for life unless the governor restored your voting rights. That's been a process that's not been readily accessible to people. So, you know, in 2010, Republican Governor Terry Branstad returned to office and rescinded executive orders under which Iowa had been governed for almost a decade that restored the right to vote to persons who had been convicted of a felony following their completion of their term of confinement, their probation, parole, and any special sentencing. And in the ensuing 10 years, probably some 40 to 50,000 people who had been convicted of a felony, lost their right to vote. The right to vote is so important. It's like feeling a whole person. It's like it's the hallmark of citizenship. It's being able to say to yourself or your child or your family, you know, I can participate in these political discussions. My point of view matters. I can vote. It's something for which people have died over the centuries. And, you know, so the NAACP meets more or less regularly with the governor. We started that back in 2010, the NAACP leadership. And we would bring this up, and one of our first approaches was to streamline the application, which had been pages and pages long. And people getting out of prison without any assistance, without any attorney to help guide them through the pages, usually didn't apply. You know, working with the prior governor and with the current governor, we worked to streamline that individual application process. A large issue, and it's a current issue right now in the state of Florida, is whether somebody who has completed his term or her term of confinement is no longer incarcerated, is not on parole or probation, but who has court costs, attorney's fees for public defenders, fines, penalties, surcharges, victims' restitution, maybe amounting to thousands of dollars, whether the person has to have paid that those costs, fees, fines, penalties, surcharges, and restitution before he or she can cast a vote, can register, lawfully register a vote. That's the issue right now being fought out in Florida, Marquis, and the Florida Federal District Court said that operates like a poll tax. It's unconstitutional. The 11th Circuit has reversed that. It's still in litigation, but in issue are, this is a constitutional amendment in Florida that drew 2/3 of the vote. In issue are the right to vote of some 750,000 people, probably a half of whom are African-American or Black. And that was a big issue. And one of the things in the NAACP working especially with this current governor, Reynolds, trying to develop where if people have payment plans of some amount, and they otherwise establish their citizenship, goodwill, she would restore their, only a small number of people were able to take advantage of it. So we also long sought executive orders such as the governor of Iowa just issued August 5th. And we, the NAACP, would meet in person with the governor on this. We met with her legal counsel. We worked with the policy director of the ACLU of Iowa. And other groups were actively, Black Lives Matter was strenuously arguing for an executive order. The governor had tried to get a constitutional amendment, which would have taken years. The Republicans tried to load it with the obligation to pay all those fees, costs, surcharges, fines, penalties, restitution, and the bill did not pass. So she did issue the executive order, which is a big deal, and now the important critical effort is to welcome those people to the role and to get them to register. You have to register to vote, and then you have to vote. There are other issues along the way which probably you'll get to. But right now we're heartened to see various organizations working to register voters, including persons who previously were convicted of a felony. And we're working with the Iowa Secretary of State to correct the website, which has been done, but now to make it clearer and really user-friendly to enable people to get their questions. How do I register? Where do I vote? What do I need to have to entitle myself to register?
Yeah, it's amazing to hear that in this digital age where everyone is getting so much of their information online, that a lot of the state governments haven't updated all of their processes to be as current and user-friendly online as well.
Well, I give our Secretary of State, Paul Pate, credit on it in April when the coronavirus pandemic was really upon us. He caused absentee ballot requests to be mailed to every registered voter in Iowa. We had the highest turnout in our June election that Iowa has ever had by a long shot. And I think 70% of those ballots were cast by mail. No fraud has been identified. The instances have been fraud. Fraud have been insignificant. You know, mm-hmm. to say they're statistically insignificant is an understatement. You know, two instances, a Republican woman wanted to vote twice for Donald Trump and did, was identified, of course. And an older woman, a grandmother, who had been released from prison following a conviction of a drug crime, a felony, mm-hmm. took her granddaughter to an uncontested municipal election council or something like that, because she thought she was governed by prior governor's executive orders and was entitled to vote. She wasn't. She was prosecuted by the county attorney and the jury acquitted her.
Wow.
So it's so Paul Pate did mail absentee ballot requests. And when the NAACP, our state president, my colleague Russell Lovell and I communicated with the Secretary of State about the website, corrections were made and we met personally with them and we've submitted further corrections to improve the user friendliness of that website.
Now, I'm thinking through on the other side for, let's say I am a felon and I am in Iowa. What are the steps that I have to take right now in order to be able to vote?
First comment I'd make is just how we look at people. We do not characterize people as felons. We talk about people who previously were convicted of a felony.
Thank you.
It's just a kind of a point of orientation, because these are people who committed a crime, mm-hmm. and they have paid a price. They're still obligated to pay the court costs and fees and fines. It's just that their right to participate in our democracy is not conditioned on the amount of money they have that is available to pay that. But they remain obligated. We want persons to be reintegrated into society. That's mm-hmm. been Governor Reynolds' strong message. She believes in second chances. And it's an important message. So there are efforts and to help people to register on the website, and the very significant number of people have access to computers and online resources. I would say it's not ideal. It's probably with in one county we saw it in African Americans, about 70% had computers or access to online resources. But there are really good videos on registering, to vote on every state Secretary of State website. But you have to register. You have to fill out a voter registration form. Mm-hmm. And the voter registration form asks for your identity, your birth date, mm-hmm. your social security number, mm-hmm. Your address, your mailing address, mm-hmm. and if you've been previously convicted of a felony, whether your rights have been restored. The governor of Iowa, and Iowa was the last state in the nation to do this, restored the right to vote of all persons who had been convicted of a felony, who by August 5th had completed their term of confinement, parole, probation, a special sentencing, with the exception of people convicted of homicide-related charges. Mm-hmm. They could still apply individually. Mm-hmm. And then she's doing it on a rolling daily basis, so it's constantly up to date. But you have to register to vote. and submit that to the Secretary of State, and you sign an affidavit or swear that certain things are true, just like any application form. As it's accepted, you become a registered voter, and then of course you have to follow through and actually vote. I'm going to add one thing, Marquis. If you have a driver's license, if you have what's called a non-operator's identification, also issued by the Department of Transportation, David Walker may not have a car. In some cities, you don't need a car, and you don't even need a driver's license, with Uber and so forth. But you may still want the identification. You can go to the Department of Transportation and get what's called a non-operator's ID. So if you have a driver's license, which has an individualized number, it's no longer your social security number, it's a computer generated letter number combination, or non-operator ID. That's all you have to put down in identifying yourself on the voter registration form. But if you don't have either, and if you've been in prison for a number of years, you likely don't have a current driver's license, and you haven't been around the Department of Transportation or one of its offices recently to get an operator, non-operator's ID, then you need what's called a voter registration number. The voter registration number is an issue in controversy now. People were mailed their voter registration numbers 2 years ago following Iowa's enactment of a voter identification law. But what did you do with the mail from 2 years ago? if it was after an election, you probably put it someplace safe that you'll never find, and your kids will, or you threw it away. So you, in this instance, people who have been incarcerated are now had the right to vote restored in order to register, can call the county auditor. The auditor is the elected county official in each county, and it's across the country, who supervises the local elections and works with the Secretary of State on statewide elections regarding registrations to vote and the receipt of ballots and counting of votes. You call the county register, and they're usually something like five questions. It's your actual residence, your male residence, your social security number, some pretty other easily answered questions, and then they will give you a voter registration number. And that's important. And they'll also tell you by what date you need to have registered to vote. But it's a one page document. If I knew how to share a screen, I could show it to you. It's on the website iowa.sos.gov, and that needs to be submitted to the Secretary of State. Fortunately, both Republican and Democratic parties are assisting people and completing those. The NAACP has voter registration drive, for example, and others do too. So registering to vote. And then voting.
I'm going to try to recap that tight. You tell me if I'm right or wrong. So what the person, once that person who has been convicted of a felony and they've paid their debt to society by serving all the time that they have, they're no longer, as they say on papers, where they're no longer serving probation or on parole. If they've paid back do the fines and restitutions have to be paid, or is that not the case in Iowa?
No, that's explicitly in the governor's executive order that they need not have paid the court costs, fees, and so forth, though they remain obligated to pay them.
But just paying their time.
just pay the time. Yeah. Just, you know, if they, they have been released from incarceration, confinement, parole, probation, they're with the exception of if they were convicted under the chapter dealing with homicide. And there's this, you know, special, or they had a special sentencing under the sex offender chapter, then mm-hmm. they have to individually apply to the governor. But the vast majority of people who are lost their right to vote because they've been convicted of felony were not convicted under the homicide or the sex offender chapter. They're most of them were people caught up in the drug war. The mm-hmm. war on drugs, you know, they were people who became addicted and they became users. So users mm-hmm. become sellers, and it's a felony, and they lost their right to vote. I mean, that's another issue on which the NAACP has been happy to support efforts of our attorney general and governor, mm-hmm. Including Governor Anstad, to reduce crowding in prisons, which our prisons have been overcrowded. So there's been an effort to increase the number who are paroled if they are convicted of a nonviolent offense and they are not found to be highly likely to reoffend. They could be paroled, but mm-hmm. that's another avenue. But so you had that right. You know, they are entitled to register to vote. They may need assistance in that. In Florida, thousands did not register, though they were entitled to, because they just mm-hmm. they didn't know how to do so, and mm-hmm. they didn't necessarily feel welcomed. So we are wanting to spread the word, and I know the parties are. I know personally the Polk County Democratic Chairman. I know he's doing a really good job, you know, welcoming everyone and his registered persons newly restored to their right to vote.
Mm-hmm. So it's basically if you've done your time, with the exception of homicide and sex offenders, if you've done your time, just go ahead and register, then make a plan, and then vote. Go to the Iowa website, fill out the form, and then you're all set. And even if you're in that latter category where you committed a homicide and you've done your time, or you're a sex offender and you've done your time, you can apply directly to the governor for a special exemption. Is that right?
For restoration of their rights. Oh. That's correct.
Yes. Awesome. And so the process to make that happen in Iowa, how could that serve as a template for other states? For example, New Hampshire.
Well, I don't know New Hampshire's laws. In Indiana, for example, Indiana's an example of a state that by judicial opinion determined that though previously convicted of a felony, once you had completed your sentence, you know, meaning your period of confinement and parole and or probation, you are entitled to vote if you were registered. In Florida, they're fighting out the issue about whether you have to have paid the fees, fines, and so forth. And there are tens of thousands affected by that. That should not be the case. You know, you remain obligated to pay those, but people with money will be able to pay those and can vote. People who don't have the vote, and it's typically hard for somebody who's just been released from prison and has a criminal record. It's been a lot harder for them to find employment. And of course, then they have rent, food. They want to start providing for their families. And so, if they owe thousands of dollars, they're unlikely to have it. And there probably be other priorities for them namely their family's health and well-being, even their own, a place to live. But, you know, if I were in New Hampshire, I would go to the Secretary of State's website and see what the rule is. Iowa was the last state in the union, Marquise, to restore the right to vote of people who had completed their term of confinement or incarceration, parole and probation. So I assume that in New Hampshire, if a person has similarly completed that term of confinement, he or she is entitled to register to vote. What I don't know about New Hampshire is whether they such a person would have to have paid all the court costs. It's $75 a night while you're in jail getting ready for trial. It's so much per hour for a public defender, the court costs and the fines, surcharges, penalties. It really does add up. But so you just have to find out what the state's law is on that. And I believe registers and auditor's offices would be helpful. Certainly, I know the Democratic Party here in Iowa is, and the NAACP are, and churches are helping people in that regard. Then the important thing is get voting, making sure you vote. Timely registering is indispensable.
Now, something else that you guys worked on along that same lines to help felons get jobs is the banning of the box. First off, what is the box so that our listeners at home, because the fact of the matter is, if you've never committed a felony, you may not have even noticed it. That's kind of, I don't want to bring in the loaded word of privilege, but privilege allows you to overlook things that don't apply to you. But those that are trapped by that box have certainly know what that is. So what is the box and what was the work that you guys did in getting rid of it?
Two quick points. It's a really important question, a good question. Second, we haven't gotten rid of it. That is a major priority, but I'll elaborate on that. Mm-hmm. The box is an area on an application that one submits for an employment opportunity that asks the person applying to say whether he or she has any criminal record. Sometimes it asks whether you've been arrested or have any criminal record other than for minor traffic offense like speeding. This is an issue that affects people, whether they're black, white, red, brown, yellow, whatever, because about 75 million adults have criminal records in the United States, Marquise. Some old to be sure, but they have it. And so you ask to say, explain, yes, and you check the box, and you may say what the offense was there. But when an employer receiving tens, maybe hundreds, conceivably thousands of applications, so usually it's in the hundreds, it's got half of those that have checked the box, and there are people with a criminal record, and half don't. Typically, they start with the half who don't. And so it is a barrier to people's being able to show that I was convicted of possessing marijuana. Mm-hmm. That was 15 years ago. I don't even smoke now. You know, I served in the military, had a good job. It was just the business was sold and there was a reduction of employment. So now I'm out of work, but that was 15 years ago. I was in college. A lot has happened since then. And, you know, the crime, possession of marijuana, has nothing to do with the job for which I'm applying. But you have to have that opportunity to explain. You have to be doing what you and I are doing right now, you know, asking a question, given the opportunity to respond. But too often, those who check the box don't even get a chance to respond. They get no interview. Or what's worse, a lot are discouraged from applying. And so about 35 states and probably 150 cities and counties around the country have banned the box. The NAACP, my colleague and I have adapted and drafted legislation that would ban the box. It's a political issue, as it would reach private employers, something like the Association of Business and Industry is very much opposed to it. Some states, of those 35 states that have banned the box, probably the 30, maybe, I haven't the correct current count, probably about 10 reach private employers as well as public employers. More typically reach public employers, and that is in some cases is defined just as the state itself. More commonly, it's defined, a public employer is defined to include not only the state, but any of its agencies and departments, the counties, county commissions, and even cities and municipalities. So it's very important. What the NAACP, and I've been a part of this, has been doing, one, working with former Governor Branstad to have the box eliminated from the application form for all state of Iowa employment. And, you know, that was done probably 4 years ago. But we have 99 counties. There are hundreds of cities and municipalities. We want to reach them as well. And so we have supported cities in the adoption of resolutions banning the box within the cities. Right now, the city of Waterloo in Iowa, in Black Hawk County, Waterloo is the Black Hawk County has the highest percentage of African American or Black people in the state of Iowa. Waterloo is about 16% African American or Black, and the council passed a ban the box ordinance. It's not on the state level, but it's a very important on the county level. And that legislation, that ordinance was challenged in court. The city council and the mayor were sued by the Association of Business and Industry. The district court upheld the ordinance. That's now on appeal to the Iowa Supreme Court. My colleague and I filed what's called an amicus curiae brief, a friend of the court brief. Supporting the city of Waterloo, ACLU of Iowa also filed a friend of the court brief, and that remains in progress. Banning the box is a really key statement. It's a major priority for the NAACP. The two points people should keep in mind: probably 75 million adults in America have criminal records of one sort or another, non-traffic offenses. And would have to check the box. And that can affect their ability to get an interview and show that the job for which they are applying is totally unrelated to the crime for which they were convicted, or that that conviction was 15 years ago when Marquise Olison was in college at 17 and 18. And you've demonstrated in any number of ways your character, qualifications, and citizenship in the ensuing 5, 10, 15 years. So we are supporting cities to draft ordinances. We are working with the governor right now on a ban the box statute. We were able to speak in favor of freeing up occupational licensing because the same problems were a barrier to your being able to get a license to pursue some occupations. And we think the governor's on commission is on record favoring ban the box at the public employer record. Some employers, Marquise, Target, stores, Bed Bath & Beyond, Principal Financial here in Iowa, Koch Industries, have simply eliminated the box on their own accord. So that's an important area, because the other point I was going to make is that people who have been incarcerated, men typically are unemployed for a year or more. It's hard to get a job. And with the erosion of jobs that has occurred in the coronavirus pandemic, it'll be harder still. And having a job, being able to support oneself and one's family, being able to contribute in that fashion is really essential to the second chance, to the reintegration, the redemption that we all want.
Because it's a job comes back to those initial things that we all need, which is a purpose. Before we had income and capital in order to justify those things, each individual person in our, you know, human collective would find their purpose within the tribe. And in that way, we've translated that into a job. And once you eliminate that purpose that you have no way that you spend the 24 hours a day, 168 hours a week, and you begin to waste away, because then you sit alone in your thoughts, and whatever is the closest influence to you becomes the thing that you think through. And it's so powerful to have that purpose reinstated and given back to you.
No question there. People want to work. They want to contribute. They want to make a difference, and it also makes them feel good. It's important to spread good.
We're going to do a vote plan here together. This is the essence of what we do, and this is hopefully some of the disenfranchised, the folks who've committed felonies, who have been disenfranchised, who now can vote, will go on our site, pick up a vote plan, and set one up for themselves, especially if they haven't voted before. We find the reason why we emphasize making a vote plan is voting is something that happens once every 2 years. Since it's one day, one thing that happens every other year, it's not within your mental processes to think through all the things that could happen on that day that throw you off of your routine. And if you haven't been able to put together why the outcomes of elections are so important to you, then the more immediate needs of your life tend to take precedence. So having a plan helps you to A, visualize why voting is important, and B, it helps you to actually think through and execute your idea of making sure you get to the polls.
If I could interject.
No, please.
Voting is at the federal and state levels, happens every 2 years in our general elections that coincide with the presidential election. And then every 2 years with at the state level as well as the congressional level. But there are other elections too. You know, school board elections are often scheduled at a different time. And so, and there are lots of ways in which people's votes matter. In a lot of cities, for example, in my wife's and my community, we had a local option sales tax that was on the ballot. That's an important issue. It's an extra penny. Sometimes sales taxes are regressive, and so that's a negative, but an additional penny that is devoted towards, for example, the arts and civic improvements, parks, walkways, trails. Those are important elections too. A few years ago, 20 years ago, a local option sales tax to support schools lost by 43 votes. Just 43 votes out of over 100,000 cast. The next time it did pass because of a big campaign such as you're assisting and spearheading, resulted in victory. And that local option school tax eventually generated over $300 million at no cost. You don't have to pay the interest on bonds to improve the technologies and restore the infrastructure of all the schools in the city of Des Moines. So there are other important elections. The second thing I would say, we do want those previously convicted of a felony to know they are welcome to vote. They are entitled now to vote. Their vote is important. We want them reintegrated into society and feel and keep on the path of citizenship. But, and I think in the last election, probably 40% of people did not vote. And a lot of people aren't registered to vote. And so we want to say to every person, just, you know, President Obama's line, don't vote. Every vote matters. You know, just out of 8 million in the state of Florida in 2018, a fraction of a percent, just 10,000, separated Senator Nelson from now Senator Scott, who prevailed. And a good article in The New Yorker talking about the vote in Florida and it's just in the coming issue, I think. It's available online. So that registration effort is really key. My wife and I do have a vote plan if you want to go through that.
I do want to go through that. And I also want to add to that, with the challenges we're seeing with the coronavirus, more and more decisions are being pushed down to local officials. The school board members used to just be in charge of different, you know, the facilities and the education of your children. Well, now those folks are literally deciding the health and safety plans of reopening schools, the barriers to put in place, the crowding of the schools, because a lot of our decision-making for that has been pushed down to the local level. So literally, the health and safety of your children and thus your entire family are pushed down to the levels of the school board. Right. Because if one of your kids catches COVID-19, though they are a lot less likely to expire because of it, they will introduce that into your home and introduce it to your family system. And that doesn't mean that you or someone else who might be immunocompromised or older isn't. And that those decisions are now being made, not at the federal level, not even in some cases the state level, but by the local school boards.
Actually, it's a current issue in the state of Iowa, because the governor is wanting schools to open at least 50% in person. We've had college and school reopenings, and people had to be quarantined. And you're right, you know, children can expose parents and grandparents to the virus, even if the children themselves are asymptomatic. But children develop the symptoms too. At the same time, and this emphasizes the importance of those local elections, you know, we do have a history of local control of education in America, and in Iowa, the governor is being sued by the state educational board and by local school boards. For example, in Ames, Iowa, just 30 miles north, where, you know, large public school there, saying, and this is a decision that the local school board, working with principals and teachers, should make, not you at the gubernatorial level. And so there's a battle for who's entitled to make that decision. But to your point, those school board elections are important.
Yeah, and it's, you know, we think of this as hopefully, theoretically, the smartest people rise to the highest levels. And then their talents of being able to get all the information from all available sources and share them out in order to pass along learnings out to everyone.
Right.
However, we're seeing things run a lot differently right now. And all of our children are then subject to whoever is the smartest person who happened to win a school board seat, who thought that that was important to do 2 years ago.
Yeah. They're hard issues because I think teachers are exposed.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody who works in the school, from the custodians, the support staff, to of course all the students, all their families. We need, in my judgment, a national coordinated approach to this pandemic. But it's certainly affecting our schools. But, you know, a lot of children don't have access to computers on a daily basis, and so online education is a tough command. Libraries are closed. That's where a lot of people access computers who don't have them in their homes. Then the socialization in schools is important, but you know the consequences of getting COVID-19 are severe too. Not just death, but you know, lingering, troubling, ranging symptoms. So
yeah, I often find that a lot of people that try to downplay COVID-19, looking at solely the number of deaths and looking at the death rate, completely ignore the lingering effects that happen once you have contracted it. And we have no idea the long-term effects. It's kind of like smoking. Well, 70 years ago, when people started smoking, they didn't know what a long-term effect was. If you smoked for 30 years, you didn't understand what was happening to your lungs. You just thought you were fine. And then 30 years later, there's this thing called lung cancer that we now can see because of correlation to the number of people who smoked to the number of people who didn't. And even to now see the effects of folks that were around the smoker who were affected by the smoking. And so some of these folks ignore, it's almost what we were talking about with Wall Street. Folks that can only focus on the short-term issue ignore that there are long-term consequences to action aside from the death that might occur from the moment that you caught it. They don't look at the shortening of life and the change of quality of life that you have to now factor in for people who contract it.
Right. I mean, sometimes, and we have 180,000 cases that prove the point. Sometimes people pay the final price, but you know, the consequences that case after case has documented of lingering physical results. Weakness, shortness of breath, difficulty walking. It's almost like a pharmaceutical company product warning. That shouldn't be overlooked either. So elections matter. Voting matters.
Yeah, all of them matter. And we're seeing more and more how each of the levels of election have more and more impact on your everyday life and the life of your family. All too often, we get so focused on the big elections, the presidential elections, and the noise that those elections generate. However, the folks that have the most ability to affect you, your life, your family, are those people that are on those down ticket elections, because they make the decisions about the things that are right there in your neighborhood.
Right. That's right.
So what we're going to do right now is we're going to go through the vote plan. I'll ask you the questions that we have on our vote plan. So election day, Tuesday, November 3rd, 2020, what is your name?
David S. Walker.
And David, will you be voting by mail or voting in person?
I'm going to be voting by mail.
Awesome. Are you already registered to vote?
I am registered to vote.
What's the most important reason you're voting this year?
Well, it's a hard question because there are so many reasons, but it involves support for jobs, workers, protections, the environment, America's position in the world, foreign alliances, just racial justice, criminal justice reform. I mean, there are many issues, the immigration law reform, dealing with climate change, reversing the terrible erosion of it's not erosion, it's willful destruction of environmental protections that the Trump administration has done. Women's reproductive freedom, the list goes on for why I'm going to be voting. But these are so important that I'm going to be voting my mail and have a plan. We've already requested our absentee ballot. I've gone to the Secretary of State's website to track my absentee ballot request, and I know that it was received. I know that the Secretary of State is going to be mailing absentee ballots to people who have properly requested them on or about October 5th. And as soon as my wife and I get those ballots, so to go through your list, I've gotten ahead of you here.
No, it's perfect. You're like, I don't have to ask the questions. You're already answering them.
We did fill out an absentee ballot request form. We, Marquise, drove it down to the auditor's office, put it in the drop box in the auditor's office. And this is something for your listeners in whatever state they may reside to check. County auditors all over the country typically have drop boxes. It's really an extension of the county auditor's office, but it may save you from driving 45 minutes to downtown Los Angeles or downtown Chicago to enable you to vote in the local public library, because there is a protected guarded drop box to the, you know, the key to which only the county auditor and the county auditor's employees have. But even drop boxes are a legal issue right now in Iowa, and will be the subject of lawsuits. And so we drove our absentee ballot request down to the county office. We otherwise would have put a 55-cent stamp on it and put it in the mail. We did it right away. This is so important. We're not going to put this on the shelf and say, well, we'll get to that this weekend. Do it now.
Just knock it out.
And it's exactly right. I didn't post a selfie at the mailbox. I'm always good with the camera, but not so good with selfies. So we're not going to vote in person. My wife and I enjoy good health. We are in our 70s, and so we are careful about those with whom we congregate, when we congregate, as we did with 8 or 9 friends last Sunday. We did it in a park, sat on benches or chairs we brought that were all about 8 to 10, 15 feet apart. Had a nice conversation over coffee for an hour and a half or 2 hours. So we socially distanced. So we're not going to vote in person. You will see a lot of people voting in person because there has been such an effort on so many fronts to suppress the vote. And that effort to suppress the vote, as you saw in Wisconsin in March, is so angering and provokes such resistance that a lot of people are going to say, I'm going to get out there. I'm going to stand in line. I'll pack lunch. And you have like LeBron James and the people in the NBA making the arenas polling places, which is absolutely terrific. And you see other efforts to support people's vote in person. Early voting is essential. We encourage early voting. The state of Florida Republican legislature banned voting on the Sunday before election. You know, it's typically black churches had it's voting and participation in the democracy, voting for a better world, better society. You know, they're do unto others as you would have them do unto you, has political transference as well. And yet that was one of the efforts of attack by the legislature to do away with Sunday voting. Such an outcry, they had to reverse that. North Carolina, their gerrymandering spearheaded with the court said they targeted African-American votes with surgical precision. And it finally was challenged successfully. But I think you're going to see a lot of people getting out to vote in person. And so the questions that you ask, having a current expiration, people carry around driver's license, for example, and they don't realize it expired 2 months ago. Mm-hmm. So that's an important thing to check. If you vote in the wrong precinct, your vote may be thrown out, probably will be mm-hmm. thrown out. So if you know, if you go to a Secretary of State's website, you can find out, where do I vote? What's my precinct? Sometimes it changes. You know, I think these suggestions that you make, childcare, gloves, mask, sanitizer, an election day kit, portable chair for sitting, particularly for older people, you know, standing in place after, you know, 40 minutes, it's hard. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, having chairs, snacks, waters, PPE, looking at the ballot ahead of time, that's a really good question to have on this form. It's a good form because there you will, sometimes there are elections that are important, maybe at school mm-hmm. board, and there are more candidates and you can only vote for three. Mm-hmm. So you educate yourself ahead of time as to who are these candidates. Some you'd support, some you would definitely not. So my wife and I, when we get our ballots, we're going to complete them and we're going to drive them down to the auditor's office. It's about, maybe it's a 30-minute round trip. Mm-hmm. We're going to vote early. Voting early is, I highly recommend voting early.
Mm-hmm.
You know, after you've educated yourself on the candidates and the issues, we're going to take it down to the auditor's box, or, you know, there are drop boxes, which people can learn where they are and do mm-hmm. that conveniently. If you can be part of an organization, ACLU of your state, the League of Women Voters, certainly the NAACP, you can encourage volunteerism with political parties, making phone calls, writing postcards. People aren't, in this coronavirus age, not going door to door. Encourage people to vote. Get out the vote. This really is a battle for what America is and aspires to be and will be.
I would love if the ACLU took our vote plan and started doing vote planning sessions, emailed it out to a bunch of members and said, hey, we'll do a Zoom call to walk you through a vote plan and get you guys together so that you can arrange a time. Everybody, just like the Iowa Polk County Dems are doing a steak fry where they're doing a big drive-through, and everybody's going to sit in the drive-in theater in their cars and eat and listen to speakers. If folks want to sit at home and then get together and do a vote plan together and everybody announces their plan and high fives virtually, that would be awesome too. Anything that encourages other people to make the active steps of visualizing what their day at the polls will look like, or what the challenges that they can do, or to think through. There's probably folks that are listening to this right now that are like, oh, I didn't even think that I could drive to the auditor's office because they've never gone. That could hear that and say, let's do that.
Right. And I will share this vote plan form with the ACLU of Iowa. The ACLU of Iowa, the ACLU nationally has been an absolute stalwart in supporting voting rights. So is the NAACP, and, mm-hmm. and I'll share this form with the NAACP as well. And we do, my wife and I have purchased tickets for the Polk County Steak Fry.
Sean Bagnitsky would be so happy to hear that.
Yeah, well, he's a tremendous guy. Yeah, he's a good friend. But I will say, out of state as you are, Marquise, you can buy a ticket to the Steak Fry and watch it online through streaming.
Oh, that's awesome.
You can do that.
I'll go find me a steak and sit there and virtually have me some, like, all right, I'm supporting the Polk County Dems.
Yeah, Speaker Pelosi is going to be one of the featured speakers. Mayor Pete is one of the featured speakers. And it's a great event. It's the Harkin, Tom Harkin Steak Fry is the ancestor, but Sean Bagnitsky is just formidable. He is an really good leader and organizer. So I'm sure you shared the plan. If you know Shaman, you know, sharing it with the NAACP and the ACLU and others, because this raises important questions. In the I will send you the voter registration form. Mm-hmm. We are, and I'll email you some of the suggestions that we have made to the Secretary of State that are under consideration for improving the user friendliness of the website. And when you deal with state government, the voter registration form is a product of different groups. There's a commission. Mm-hmm. And so there are a couple sentences that and I'll tell you what ones that we're looking to change, because they, right out of the box, it says, if you've been convicted of a felony, you're not qualified to vote unless you've had your rights restored. It's kind of a blast of cold air.
I have a friend that's doing voter registration in Wisconsin, and there are so many people that have been tossed off the rolls for one reason or another. And because of COVID-19, because people have moved.
You know, the purging that has been done by Republican secretaries of state, matching lists with citizenship lists, for example. That article in the New Yorker, I think it's coming out in print, I read it online, about the suppression in the 2000 election, the Bush-Gore election. Mm-hmm. And of course, you know, the suppression in Georgia that took place in the Brian Kemp, Stacey Abrams gubernatorial election. Mm-hmm. Voter suppression is an ugly, nasty technique, but it is real, and it needs to be fought, and it needs to be defied. Stacey Abrams is waging a good fight. Eric Holder, you are. So keep it up.
Awesome. Thank you. How should the people who want to find you, do you have social media, websites? How would people who want to say, you know what, I want to holler at David Walker to say some beautiful words to him, how would they find you?
Well, I'm a retired faculty member at Drake University, but my email there is david.walker@drake.edu.
Awesome. Well, David, this has been 100% my pleasure. I've really, really enjoyed having this conversation, and I think people are going to benefit all across the country as they wake up to how they can start the process to making sure that if you have committed a crime in your past, that you can rehabilitate yourself and enter in and become a fully whole citizen of the United States of America, where you get to participate in the making of the story of this country. Being able to vote, being able to serve on a jury, being able to pay your taxes, being able to contribute and serve your country in the various ways that you can, are part of what makes this place great.
And can I add one point?
Yes, please.
Being able to serve on a jury. Mm-hmm. People who were convicted of a felony were disqualified from serving on a jury. And so we estimated that might have disqualified 10 to 15,000 African Americans in the state of Iowa. Mm. And the composition of a jury, you know, studies have shown and are confirming, is very important in terms of the outcome. And whether the jury is all white or has even one African American on it, they will convict a white person at about the same rate. Mm-hmm. There's no difference, you know, a racially mixed jury, an all white jury, a white defendant. Mm-hmm. But if Marquise Olison is the defendant and you are a person of color, a white jury will convict you about 81% of the time. Mm. And a racially mixed jury will convict you 66% the time. And wow. the quality of deliberations, the candor in the jury room is measurably, demonstrably, consequentially improved by having people of color serving on juries. And so that is a major initiative that my colleague Russ Lovell and State President Betty Andrews for the NAACP have been waging in court and on appeal. So that qualification to serve on the jury is important, and you know, I hope your listeners will not say, jury duty, ugh, I don't want to do that. That is a really important aspect of citizenship and the rule of law.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is voting in election day is one of those ways where we choose our leaders, and serving on a jury is that other way where we literally decide the fate of our fellow man. It's what got us away from having a king being able to dictate who lives and who dies. It becomes a part of our human fabric where we are all the jury. We are all the deciders of the fate and deciding of crimes. And so if people have decided that the time that it takes to be a citizen and the time it takes to measure the weight of someone's life is so beneath them, then you have to ask what's going to happen when something happens to you, when you're sitting in that box, if you are innocent.
Right. Or innocent of the charge. Done something, but it wasn't robbery or it wasn't second degree murder, both of which have mandatory minimum sentences.
Mm-hmm.
And, or you may be factually innocent. You're right.
Well, I say that because most people visualize if they're ever going to be put in a situation that they didn't do it. So if in order for them to be able to have empathy, they have to visualize the case where they may have been put in a situation where they may have been wrong place, wrong time, and they feel that they themselves should not be tried, but here they are. And when they find themselves in that situation, do you want a jury of a bunch of people who say, I don't want to be here? Or do you want a jury of folks that are citizens listening to you as you would want to listen to them?
Right. Right. Absolutely.
This has been awesome. I've had so much fun, and I've got to invite you back. And when I get to Iowa, we're going to have, we got to have some steak.
That's great. Absolutely. You come see us. And that's a good initiative you have here. And encourage people to vote and have get a plan to do so. And so thank you for that.
No, thank you. And thank you, listeners. This is Marquise with Vote Plan. I'm going to be signing out. I just want to let you guys all know you can find us at Vote Plan 2020 on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram and TikTok. You can find me, Marquise Olison, at Marquise Olison on Instagram. You can find me at The Keese on Twitter and the Facebook. Thank you so much. I really wish that you would stay socially distant while this whole coronavirus is going on. Wear your mask, be kind to each other, wash your hands, and make sure that you vote on or before Election Day.